Welcome back to the Big Show podcast here at Podomatic.com. I'm your host, Robert Henson. Thanks for tuning in for another Big Show podcast. And tonight we're pretty excited. We're interviewing author Crystal Zevon. She's the wife of famous guitar player, famous musician Warren Zevon. She was asked by her late husband to write his biography, and she did it, and it's now out in paperback. It's called I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. Our guest on the podcast today is author Crystal Zevon.
Yeah, he loved Philly. He definitely had a relationship with the town, and you're right. He was a songwriter and a genius in his own right, but he was also an entertainer. He loved to entertain.
Now, Crystal, I want to ask you. It was one of Warren's requests I get to complete his biography after he died. Talk to me a little bit about how that came up. Was that towards the end of his life, or had you guys talked about that kind of for years before he actually died?
Well, back in the 70s, I mean, we actually used to write chapters for his biography before he made what's sort of commercially considered his first album. The self-titled album. So it's not that it was something we hadn't ever talked about. We had talked about it through the years in the 70s, but then it hadn't been mentioned again for many, many years. But when he was diagnosed with mesothelioma, which is an inoperable form of cancer, in the first week after the diagnosis, he told me he and Carl Hiaasen, his good friend, the writer, had talked about it and felt that I was the person to do it. I was the person who was sort of there for the rise and perhaps fall, as it were. And we kept in touch and remained close friends and confidants throughout the years.
Did it seem weird, though, being asked to, like, hey, Crystal, you know, can you put this together? Because really, with Warren's diagnosis, with the amount of time you spend together, even though remaining friends, you guys had your ups and downs, to say the least, to not give it all away. How did you feel about, I could unload on you. You're Warren Zevon. I could unload. I could give the deepest, darkest. I could give the realest of real. Where did you feel in yourself to be able to say, okay, I will tell his story as honestly as I could?
Well, I think when he asked me, it was a year later that he died. When he asked me, you know, I was just recovering. I wasn't, you know, I was still in the state of shock from the fact that he was dying. I think it was in total denial, in fact. I don't think I believed it. And, you know, but because he'd just given me that news, I wouldn't have said no to anything he asked me. And so I don't think the reality of it struck me until sometime later. We talked about it through the last year of his life, and more in terms of, you know, he'd talk about things that were important to him, you know, the memories that he had. And, you know, he was a reader of biographies and believed that, you know, the sort of inner lives of artists should be shown and known. So then the last, about a week before he died, he called me up to kind of say, so you are going to do this thing. And, you know, then it started to strike me, well, he's really serious. And, but again, I don't know, it didn't really hit me until after he was gone.
Now, the book itself, you know, it's not just your voice. It's not, you know, the book isn't titled, you know, How I Remember Warren Zevon by Crystal Zevon. There's so many different voices in it. Everyone from yours to people he wrote with, people he toured with, your children. How did you start selecting how people were going to tell the story and who was going to tell the story, really? Not how, but who was going to be telling the stories in this?
You know, I didn't select. I just sort of let it happen. It was sort of osmosis. Originally, I think what he thought and what I thought is that I would write a traditional biography. But then, exactly like you just said, I didn't want to be the one to interpret, you know, what he was thinking when he wrote that line. Or, you know, I know there are musicologists who do it. I'm not one of them. And so I started calling people up and thought, you know, he was such an eclectic character, such a complex guy, and different people knew him in different ways, and different people even described the same event in a different way, as from their memories. So So I decided to do this kind of oral history, and I just started calling people up. I started chronologically. I started with a guy I knew who was his childhood friend. I talked to his relatives, and a lot of the early life stuff was cut out of the book. But I mean, you know, enough is there to give him some history. But and then I just, you know, everybody I'd talk to would say, "Oh, you've got to talk to so and so and so and so and so and so." And that's kind of how it went.
And it just built from there. I have to ask because, you know, you mentioned, you know, the type of guy he was and how eclectic he was. We're speaking with Crystal Zeebon. Her book is called I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. It's The Dirty Life and Times of Warren Zeebon. It's out on paperback now. You talk about him being eclectic. I will admit, you know, although a fan of Warren Zeebon's music, after reading sections of this book, you know, and especially some of the dealings in his family, the tale your daughter tells about, you know, going to stay with him and he didn't get out of bed till 2 o'clock. You know, I'm not sure if I became his biggest fan on a personal level. You know, just kind of summing it up for people who haven't read the book yet. You know, what kind of guy was Warren Zeebon when it came to family? Because honestly, you know, as a musician, he sounded great. As an entertainer, we all know how fabulous he was. He had some failings when it came to family.
He had some major failings when it came to family, and he knew it. I mean, he owned that. He, you know, Warren's best friends were Carl Hiaasen, the writer, and Jorge Calderon, his co-writer. And he confided in and trusted them with so much, and I think he looked up to them in a way because they were men who were artists, who had monogamous relationships, who, you know, who doing their kids' homework with them came first, you know, came above going in or locking themselves in a room to do the writing. And he didn't feel like he was capable of doing that. I mean, Warren was tested as a genius and went way off the charts, I mean, above Einstein. So, you know, he had this mind that just never stopped. And it was very difficult, those simple things. But he longed for that. And I think once his children got a little bit older, he developed relationships with them. And I also think if you read the book to the end, at the end of his life, I mean the very end, but I believe he willed himself to stay alive for the birth of his grandchildren. And I think in the end, that's what really mattered, and that's what he came to realize.
Our guest tonight, Crystal Zeebon. It's out in paperback, New York Times bestseller, I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. It's The Dirty Life and Times of Warren Zeebon. And Charlie, you had a question.
Yeah, back in 1987, I think it was 87, Warren released an album called Sentimental Hygiene. And I'm guessing this is after he went to rehab and sobered up, or one of the times that he sobered up. That album was great. That's one of my favorite, if not my favorite, Warren Zeebon album. Has a couple of really good tunes on it, Bad Karma being probably my favorite. But I understand after that, the alcoholism or the alcohol problem was sort of supplanted or replaced by OCD, tics and mannerisms. Am I correct in that?
Yeah.
Were you together when that happened?
No.
Because I'm... Before you go on, I know it's hard living with somebody with OCD. I was wondering if, even if you weren't living together, do you have any stories to relate as far as that goes?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I think it wasn't something that happened when he stopped drinking. I think he always had it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it became clearer because it was just really out there. There was no, you know, we covered things up by thinking, oh, he's just crazy drunk. But in fact, there was something beyond that going on. You know, there were things that he would do, like Warren avoided the draft during the Vietnam War, by going to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist wrote a note saying he was gay. And you know, he had this sense of right and wrong, and this super sense of honesty, and you know, to be dishonest would bring bad luck, not only to him but to others. So he had a thing, he had an obsession with anything that had an image of Uncle Sam on it. If you passed a billboard driving down the street and you went past a billboard of Uncle Sam, you had to turn around and drive back so that you were going away from it and then take another street to get to your destination. It was, you know, he had these little ritual behaviors that, you know, if he brushed up against a cashmere sweater in a store, he had to go back and he had to pat it a certain number of times and then walk around the table and then walk back past it without brushing up against it. Opening Cokes, it was the sound of how a Coke opened. And so when you had it, opened a can of Coke, psh, psh, nope, not that one's bad luck, that one's bad luck.
Was that something that OCD is a difficult disease to live with if you don't have it, if your partner has it. But do you think he had as many problems with his addiction that he did because he was one of those people who self-medicated rather than you know, saw a doctor for it, or did he have it taken, at least have a doctor look at that?
No, he didn't. You know, when Warren got sober, he like he was with everything. There weren't a lot of gray areas, even though gray was the only color he would ever wear. But when he got sober, he wasn't going to take anything for anything. He had migraine headaches, and he wouldn't take, I think he finally would take aspirin, but, you know, he wouldn't take anything stronger than that. So he was a little bit rigid in some of his habits where he might have been helped, you know.
Crystal Zeevan is our guest. The book's called I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. It is The Dirty Life and Times of Warren Zeevan. It's out on paperback. You know, Crystal, you know, we talk about how many different voices are in this book telling this story. You know, as yourself and growing up with, or, you know, growing up, but, you know, living with and living apart from Warren, how did you discuss it or reconcile some of the family issues that are in this book? How did you as a parent reconcile it as compared to some of the descriptions in there and how Warren reconciled some of his behaviors or your family dynamic?
I'm not completely sure I know what you're getting at.
Like issues with when you talked about, you know, how he was getting better as the kids got older, and he was able to relate with them. The things, you know, Warren wanted out of a family, but the things he wasn't quite able to connect. How do you explain that to your children as they're growing up? And you're, you know, this is Daddy. He's very famous. He writes a lot of songs. Little quirky. How do you have that discussion with your children?
You know, when my daughter was younger, when we moved to France, and he hadn't been seeing her, he'd moved to Philadelphia, actually, and she used to put his records on and sit and cry. What I said to her was, you know, your daddy loves you, but he loves you in the way he knows how to love, and it's not the same way that we know how to love each other. It's a really difficult thing to see your child get all dressed up waiting for her dad to come pick her up, and, you know, he shows up 4 hours late. And she's sitting out in front of the house refusing to come in and eat her peanut butter sandwich. You know, I am certainly not alone in having experienced that. But then Warren would be racked with guilt, and being racked with guilt would make the separation greater. It was a difficult thing for a long time. And, you know, I think you deal with it as the parent who's with the child by trying to compensate with more love or, you know, extended family. My daughter spent a lot of time with my parents.
Well, I'll tell you, those stories in the book, and once again, it's called I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. It's The Dirty Life and Times of Warren Zeevan. Those stories in the book, I'll tell you, as I was reading them, they're heart-wrenching to hear that side of the tale. So I was real curious just about, you know, your reactions to it and how you as a parent had to go, you know, I have to, maybe for lack of a better term, take up the slack on this side to explain that. Charlie, you had another question?
Yeah, when he was diagnosed and when he was dying, he started turning up all over the place. I mean, there's no other way to put it. Was he using his diagnosis to, I don't know, not necessarily promote, but sort of like gain a foothold for, you know, his legacy?
Absolutely.
He made
an absolute conscious decision. For the first few days after he was diagnosed, it was like, you know, he was calling up saying, well, maybe why don't we go to India and, you know, I'll die and you'll spread my ashes in the Ganges. Or, you know, I mean, he what do you do when you're given a death sentence? And, you know, then it was very clear to him pretty quickly. I make music. That's what I do. He, you know, his career was at rock bottom. And his business managers had sold his life insurance policies to pay back taxes, so he didn't even have anything to leave his children. And he made a decision to use this death sentence to his advantage. So promote is exactly the right word.
It was a marketing tool. It was. I mean, it seemed that way, but yet I wasn't put off by it. It's weird. It was almost as if I couldn't not watch it. You know, whenever something about Warren Zevon, if he was going to turn up on Letterman or he's going to turn up someplace else, I had to watch. And there was this, I don't remember what the name of the show was, but it was a documentary chronicling.
The VH1 thing. Yeah,
the VH1 thing. And, you know, he was, now, I don't know what really went on behind the scenes. They had, in quotes, behind the scenes footage, you know, throughout the whole thing. But I'm not exactly sure how he was feeling. But the reaction shots of some of the people he was working with were amazing. Like, I think it was Timothy Schmidt. Was he in there? If he was, he was the guy that looked horrified because Warren wanted to finish, like, a certain song. And the other guy was playing bass. And, you know, Warren was so matter of fact, you know, I'm dying, but we got to do this. And the reaction shot of his friend was, I can't believe you're saying this. I can't believe I'm working on this project. You know, could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you know, what happened was when after his diagnosis, I think Warren had been sober for 17 years and he got scared. The night that he started drinking again, which none of us knew for some time that he had started drinking again, was the night our daughter had an engagement party. She got engaged. And I think suddenly, while he'd been going sort of full force ahead with this marketing plan to keep his legacy alive, to leave something for his children, for all the right motives, all the right reasons, so it distracted him from thinking about the fact that he was dying. But at this engagement party, he looked at his daughter about to get married and got scared, realized there was some stuff he was going to miss out on. And that night he left the party with the woman he'd come with, and they went stopped for something to eat. She ordered a glass of wine, and he did too. So from that point on, he had his manager sneaking things into his Mountain Dew and so on, and it became a trial to work with him. And Jorge Calderon, I think, his writing partner, who also co-produced The Wind, it becomes pretty clear in that VH1 video that he almost reached a breaking point. I mean, you know, at one point, Jorge's wife and daughter showed up on his birthday to bring him a birthday cake at the studio, and Springsteen was coming the next day, and he wouldn't let them in. You know, I mean, it was crazy.
The book is called I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. It's The Dirty Life and Times of Warren Zevon by Crystal Zevon. It's in the voices of all kinds of people he's worked with, legendary artists, family members, friends. Crystal, as you went through these stories, and I'm sure you had a chance to re-reflect on stories you remember living, other tales you were told, everybody can take something from this book. You know, fans of Warren Zevon can take something from this book at the end, you know, whatever they get from it, whether it's happy, sad, indifferent. In your opinion, after looking and re-listening to these stories and maybe reliving some of them, what do you take from this now, you know, that it's all done? You know, happy, sad, I know you can't be indifferent, but what did you get at the end of this?
You know, it was a roller coaster ride. Reading his journals was one of the hardest things I ever did, but by the same token, doing the interviews was a cathartic process of, you know, reconnecting with people or connecting with new people, and we got to share our sorrows and joys. But in the end, I would hope people would read to the end, because I think in the end what happened for Warren was our daughter was pregnant, and I think he willed himself to stay alive for the birth of his grandsons. She had twins. and just a couple of months before he died. And I think the album was done, the accolades were out there, and he succeeded in what he tried to do with his career. But suddenly what emerged was what was really important, you know, family and the relationships with the people he loved and the people who loved him.
You know, that last album, The Wind, I really enjoyed that album. And it when you think of songs and songwriting, I don't necessarily equate Warren Zevon with quiet introspection. There's introspection, but there's
right.
not. But there's, it's not quiet. But you know, but it is an album that's sort of like it's a quiet exclamation point. Did you like the album?
Yeah, I liked it.
That's one of my three. Well, I mean, you know, it's easy for me to say because I'm sort of, you know, I'm not involved with your predicament there. But that's one of my three favorite Warren Zevon albums. And I got to imagine that. When you hit it big with a song like Werewolves of London, and it's not necessarily a novelty song, but that is your signature song.
Right.
I've got to believe that afterwards, you've got to be striving for something that will leave a mark other than your signature song. Did he feel like that, or am I missing it?
Oh, no, he definitely did. I mean, you know, the songs that he's most well-known for, like Werewolves of London or Excitable Boy, are songs that were written very quickly and, you know, sort of inspirations of the moment. But the songs that he worked on for years, that he crafted, that, you know, one line would have to be perfect before it could be done, and that could change 200 times, you know, he's not so well-known for. And probably that is the real body of work that I think he would hope people would go back and discover.
Crystal Zevon.
He always believed he'd be discovered after death, by the way.
Crystal Zevon's our guest this evening. The book is called I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, New York Times bestseller, out in paperback. Crystal, if you could, the title, I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, the story behind that phrase.
Well, I mean, it kind of came out of a fight that we had where I was saying, you know, you've got to sleep sometime or you've got to get to bed. Warren would get obsessed with new instruments or something. And he had a synthesizer at one point. I think this is the first time it happened. I mean, it was a song that came over time, too. But and he figured out how to make the sound of a train, like it went into the tunnel and came out of the tunnel. And I was trying to sleep. I had a job. I had to go to work. And we had a huge fight over it. And he said, I'll sleep when I'm dead. And from there, yeah. It went on. I mean, he may have had the line before that, though. You know, something funny is happening, that some of the stories that are in there. I mean, I was there when Werewolves of London was written. And lately, just recently, I heard from a guy who had an apartment in the same building as Warren's in the early 60s, he was much younger before I knew him, who says he wrote the song then. So, who's to say? I mean, I was literally there and took notes when Waddy Roy and Warren wrote Werewolves of London, but now I'm hearing that it was written at a different time.
Do former side men or musicians like Waddy Wachtel or Dan Dugmore or Gerf Morlix, do they stay in touch, or is that just a different life from you?
No, I'm in touch. I'm in touch with a lot of the people. I'm not with everybody, but, I just moved to Vermont about 5 or 6 years ago. I was in L.A. before that. They're friends.
Now, I know the book's out in paperback now, so you've probably had plenty of reaction from friends and from family. When the book first came out, I mean, you know, you were asked to put this together. You could have done anything you wanted to. You could have hammered Warren in it. Like you said, you could have written the typical biography. You could have made him out to be a saint, a star. What kind of react? I think you did a little bit of all of those in those, actually. But what sort of reaction did you get from his friends, from the stars, from the family when the book originally came out?
From the most heartening thing was I heard right away from people like Carl Hiaasen and Dave Barry and Billy Bob Thornton and Jackson Browne. They loved the book. And, you know, they, most of them, yeah, all of them actually saw it before it came out. And they all said this is the book Warren would have wanted, even though I don't think it's what he, what we were talking about when he and I talked. And then critically, it was Janet Maslin loved it, Rolling Stone loved it. It was critically acclaimed. So I was kind of blown away because I was just doing the job. I wasn't thinking ahead that far. As for the family, Warren's relations, his cousins and so on, were all very pleased. You know, my family, it brought back some difficult memories. Ariel and Jordan, his children, neither one of them has completely read it.
Really?
Well, it's just, you know, it's their dad.
Yeah.
And regardless, and, you know, they talk to me, you know, I mean, they certainly told the truth, and they will say that. They say, you know, everything's true, but, you know, they kind of made their peace with him before he died. So, you know, I think it's kind of a, do we really need to go back there?
Crystal, are you too close to this, or let me just ask, do you have a favorite Warren Zevon song? Is that a fair question?
Sure. I mean, I think about it a lot, and, you know, the favorite song, of course, changes from time to time, but I think if I look at the whole body of his work, the songs that continually and consistently stand out for me, Desperados Under the Eaves.
Yeah.
And the other one I love is Don't Let Us Get Sick off of Life Will Kill You. And well, I love that I love two songs that are at either end of his career, really.
Well, Crystal, I want to thank you for coming on the show. Crystal Zevon's been our guest. I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, The Dirty Life and Times of Warren Zevon is out in paperback, the New York Times bestseller, so make sure you get one. It really is a great book. It's given me a completely different perspective on him. And as I said, as a reader, it was a roller coaster. I liked him. Yeah. I didn't like him. Liked him again. Didn't really like him again. It was really a good read, Crystal.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us at the Big Show Podcast here at Podomatic.com. Remember, if you go to WCOJ.com, you can listen to the Big Show live with streaming audio. Just go to WCOJ.com, click on the Big Show, and then click on the icon for streaming audio. It's WCOJ.com. You can hear the show live weekdays from 4 to 7 at 1420 WCOJ, right outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. For all of us at The Big Show, I want to thank you for being here for the podcast. We look forward to being back with you soon.
I was gambling in Havana. I took a little risk.
Yeah.
Send lawyers, guns, and money.